want to welcome you to the February 2017 HPVQI conference call. Big kudo for everybody. We had everybody turn in numbers for cycle one for January. So way to go. That is awesome. Just a reminder, we have to do consecutive cycles to be eligible for the MOC credit. So we'll just keep going with that. One item of business. We do need to change our April conference call to be the second Tuesday in April. That will be April 11th, still at 7:30 a.m. What we're going to do now is turn the time over to Dr. Deanna Kepka, who has invited an advocate. So Deanna, go ahead.
We're really excited to have Chandra Hall here with us today as our first HPV advocate for the Intermountain West HPV Vaccination Coalition. So the reasoning we thought that it would be really, really helpful to include HPV advocates on our calls is to give pediatricians and their teams a personal experience or personal understanding of how HPV-related cancers and precancers impact people's lives. So we welcome Chandra, who's going to talk a little bit about her experience with an HPV-related cancer and all of the activities that she's currently involved in now. Good morning, Chandra.
Thank you for inviting me to speak today. Deanne, do you want me to just start with kind of the beginning of my journey?
So we'd like Chandra to tell us a little bit about her experience with an HPV-related cancer.
So when I was 17, a few years ago, I had my very first Pap exam, and it actually came back abnormal. And I had talked to some of the girlfriends that I was going to high school with at the time, and many of them shared with me that their experience, they had had abnormal Pap as well. And so I wasn't too particularly concerned because I had connected with other young women with a similar experience. And so, as I'm sure most of the people on this call know, that it takes many, many years for HPV infection typically to turn into full-on invasive cancer. So on and off throughout the years, I had clean Pap for several years, and then I'd have maybe an abnormal. They'd do a watch and wait. Maybe they would do a procedure like a LEAP or a cold cone or cryo or whatever the standard was of that time. And then I'd have clear Paps for several years. Well, got married at 25, started to plan for a family at 27, and after a year, no pregnancy, found out that I actually had gone, even though I'd gone 4 years for completely clean Paps, I had a 9x8 millimeter tumor on my cervix, and they couldn't get it, excise it locally in the hospital under general anesthesia, so I had to have a hysterectomy. So at that time, we're talking late 90s, there really wasn't much talk about HPV in general, and I didn't even know that cervical cancer was an HPV-related disease until probably 2 years after treatment. And I live in the fifth largest city in the United States now, at that time, which I'm still now here in Phoenix. And you would think that there would be a little bit more buzz and education and awareness about HPV, just generally speaking, for being such a large city with excellent access to care. But I didn't know anything about it until I started connecting with other women that had had cervical cancer. And they had started sharing with me that their doctors had told them that their cancer was caused by HPV. So I started digging a little bit deeper, and that's when I learned more about HPV-related disease.
Thank you so much for sharing. Can you tell me a little bit more about the medical treatments you received at that time?
Absolutely. So I was lucky. I hit what my gynecologic oncologist said. I kind of hit the cancer lottery. The residual cancer was only about the size of a pinky nail. So at that time, although they relocated my ovaries to prepare my pelvic region for radiation, it was determined that radiation and chemotherapy were not going to be part of my protocol. Now, I understand I was stage 1A, And I understand that nowadays many women do undergo chemotherapy and radiation for my same stage, my same type, the same grade, and it was quite an aggressive cancer. However, at that time, it was decided that that probably was not, they wanted to be more conservative, I'll say, mostly because I was so young. And doing an oophorectomy and removing my ovaries, my physician was concerned that throwing me into premature menopause would cause a lot more challenges, because at that time, that's right when the whole HRT being related to cardiac challenges or issues was starting to kind of circulate throughout the medical community, and it was thought that hormone replacement therapy was really not appropriate. So they elected to leave my ovaries in and let me go through typical quote-unquote menopause as I age. But of course, having my uterus removed and everything else kind of threw me into premature menopause anyway.
Sounds like you have had long-term effects from these treatments.
I have, absolutely. So I have lymphedema in my legs. As I age, it tends to get a little bit worse, so I have to be very careful about that and just monitoring that. It is manageable. You know, not to disclose too much, but I will be brutally honest with this particular group that there are a lot of sexual and intimacy challenges that come along with a gynecologic cancer. I, thank goodness, did not have to have a radiated pelvis or vaginal canal. However, again, many women do, and if you can imagine trying to be intimate with somebody in such a tender area, it tends to be a challenge, to say the very least. So you have to learn basically how to be a sexual being all over again in new and different ways, and with that comes with the challenges on how to relate with your partner again. Most women, they say, tend to have sex mentally. It's a mental game, whereas most men, not all, tend to view it as a physical act. And so when you've got a woman that's feeling poorly about herself, that's in a lot of pain, and then physically she's not able to perform in ways that her partner, be it male or female, have come to know them, it adds a complete new level of challenges to that relationship and to the emotional well-being of that patient.
Thank you so much for sharing. So how has this affected your family life?
So needless to say, we have no children, so that was our biggest obstacle to overcome. You know, here we were trying to get pregnant, we found out we weren't going to get pregnant, we found out we had cancer, and so not having children as part of the family unit was a huge hurdle for us to figure out how to navigate. I'm happy to say that we have been able to have very fulfilling and loving lives with our friends' children, and we are able to mentor the youth of our friends and our family and sisters and brothers and nieces and nephews, so that's been an absolute blessing. But early on, when the family, my family unit being my husband, my parents, my sisters, were trying to wrap their arms around this, they were really embarrassed. They didn't want to tell anybody that their family member had a sexually transmitted infection that resulted in cancer, and they especially didn't want to talk about a cancer that was below the belt, as we say. And so even my own family didn't want to embrace it or acknowledge it. And so as you can imagine, as I went along and started advocating and supporting other women with similar situations, that was tough for them to swallow. But you know, at the end of the day, I was in it for women like me who were scared and had nobody to relate to. And so over the years, they have come to embrace the advocacy work and the works that we do trying to support women with all gynecologic cancers. And then more importantly, you know, the opportunities that have come with this to speak with amazing organizations such as this to help them relate to how this affects their practice and how it affects, potentially can affect, the people that they're trying to care about as well.
So you have been a phenomenal advocate and leader in cervical cancer coalition building and education. Can you tell us a little bit about your work that you've been doing in that area in Arizona and in the United States?
Well, you know, it's all been organic. I say that, you know, no young girl starts her first day at kindergarten and say, you know what, when I grow up, I want to be a cervical cancer advocate, and I'm going to talk about sexually transmitted infections and penises and vaginas and vulvas and, you know, anal lesions and all that. I mean, that just is not ever on the radar. But it boils down to see a need, fill a need. And when I was so scared and newly diagnosed and I had nobody to relate to, I thought, I know that I'm not the only one going through this. I've got to find a way to connect with other women. And so with that, I discovered the National Cervical Cancer Coalition. They were having a conference, and I thought, man, I've got to get there. I know it's going to be life-changing. I don't know how. And coming from Phoenix to Washington, D.C., the price tag that came along with that was astronomical just for travel expense. So I swallowed my pride, and I went into my boss, and I asked my boss to borrow the money for a salary advance. God bless him. He financed my whole trip. And so I really have to give the glory to him for all this advocacy work, because he easily could have said no, but he didn't. He said yes. So I went to that conference, and I connected with other women that were just as scared and terrified and trying to heal as I was, and realized that the message of that organization was so powerful, I had to bring it back and really help disseminate information. And this was a perfect organization that was reliable and trustworthy, and I could bring the information I learned from them, share it with my friends. And that's how it all started. I just started sharing information with my friends, and I started connecting with gynecologists in the area. And I worked at a cancer hospital, so I started connecting with them as well, you know, with my colleagues. And throughout that, just one opportunity has led to another. And I found Intermountain West HPV Vaccination Coalition, which has been absolutely phenomenal in helping promulgate and support and advocate for the vaccine. So it has been a wild ride. I mean, a little girl from Okemos, Michigan, never in a million years thought that this would be her life. And yet here we are. And I'm just glad that I just really was able to take a really crappy situation that nearly broke my heart and turned it into something where I can support other women and be there for them.
Yes, you are amazing. And I knew when I had this opportunity to invite an HIV advocate, I'm like, I have to get Chandra for the first call. So we're so happy that you're here. What messages would you like to share to pediatricians who are working to improve HPV vaccination in their clinic?
A fantastic opportunity to speak with pediatricians, because they are our frontliners, right? They are the ones that have that critical touch point with the parents to get them the vaccination to the children and in the youth at the appropriate age. Many times when I'm speaking and doing my advocacy work, or I'm on the Hill and talking to our elected officials all about supporting various healthcare initiatives that have to do with women's cancers, you know, the horses have been out of the barn and run free, because it's that group, the adults that I'm talking to most of the time. It is so absolutely critical that pediatricians have that conversation with parents or guardian of the youth, because that is the demographic that we need to get these vaccines. And it's not that I am necessarily pro-vaccine. I think that it is amazing and wonderful, but the perspective I come from is I don't have children, so how far be it from me to try and lecture a parent on what they do with their child. So I feel that it is within my scope to educate parents on what the vaccine can do, and then just like with this group, say, look, this has the ability to prevent your young women in your life from having slash burn and poison method that is cancer treatment today. If they don't have to keep having their cervix biopsied and chip away every couple of years and have this tissue removed and have them have their cervixes compromised to the point where they might not be able to carry a child full term, might not be able to get pregnant, always have to look over their shoulder once they do receive HPV, because once it's in you, it changes your DNA, and then as our immune systems break down, that's when it starts getting nefarious and begins to grow and cause trouble. And so we need more pediatricians just to educate the parents on it. And really, nowadays, parents, we're finding, and finally this day has come, that they're not so anti-HPV vaccine anymore. They understand that the myths out there are no longer true, and that when their trusted physician leader says, look, this is a matter of course. We're going to give the child A, B, C, and D as a part of that, the HPV vaccine as a part of that, and then in a couple years, we're going to give this, this, and this vaccine. Then the parents trust them and know that their trusted physician is not going to steer them in the wrong direction. It doesn't have to be a long, drawn-out, blown-out conversation. And I don't really think that the pediatricians are as apprehensive as having that conversation with parents or guardians anymore that they once were when there was a huge anti-vax movement and a lot of misinformation out there. I'm happy to report that now many parents fully understand now that it is for male youths as well as female. And that it is a matter of course, it should be a matter of course, in keeping their children healthy. It's a health issue. It's not a sex issue anymore. And so we're finally seeing that paradigm shift. And it is all because of the efforts with the youth physician leaders and pediatricians, thankfully. We're so grateful to them.
Thanks so much, Chandra. We really, really appreciate your time and your insight and sharing your story. Does anyone have a question for Chandra?
This is Elisa, and a question was posed by Dr. Cosgrove. So Chandra, would you describe the emotional toll that you have dealt with in confronting cancer and confronting infertility?
Well, certainly. Thank you for that question. And I have to tell you, to kind of put a fine point on that question, the emotional toll rears its ugly head every time I have these conversations, because I kind of choke my way through it. I literally a couple of times have caught myself welling up with tears because it's not easy to relive this journey. Oh, now here I am, I'm doing it right now. It's not easy to continue to pick at that scab, right? So most women, when they go through something that's pretty tough, don't kid yourself. I know how lucky I am. I am eternally grateful I did not have to have chemo and radiation, because those women are the damaged of the damaged. And I'm so thankful I didn't have to go through all that. But at the end of the day, you know, it is a lifetime of having to explain why I don't have kids. You know, how many kids do you have? Well, I don't have any. Oh, no, why not? Oh, you didn't ever want to have kids? No, we tried. It just didn't work out. You know, it's all about finessing the message. Then once you share, well, I had a gynecologic cancer, then you have to read your audience. And are they really up for that conversation? Do you have an opportunity to educate? If I do, absolutely I do it. Then sometimes I get beat up and I encounter the anti-vaxxers, and then they start cramming down their agenda down my throat and how it's awful, the stuff that we're spewing about the HPV vaccine and how it's not appropriate. So then I've gone from just answering a simple question to trying to have this great big political debate. And sometimes I'm up for it. Most times I'm not. I'm just out in a social setting with my husband trying to have a nice evening out with friends or at a gathering. So there isn't a day go by that I'm not reminded. I have a scar on my abdomen that goes from one side of my hip to the other. And so just by showering on a daily basis, like, oh, yep, here it is. Nope, can't forget about that. And, you know, the physical changes in my body as well. And so it is very much a mental game, but gratitude and having a grateful heart for being able to turn something in that was just a really crappy situation into something that potentially might help others, that's what refills my bucket. So either you can curl up and just be sad and go into a deep depression, which a lot of women do, or you can try and use that as your fuel to power forward and make a difference. And the balancing act, I won't kid you, it's not easy. And many days it's harder than others, but I do the best that I can with what I've got, just like the rest of us.
Thank you for sharing your story. Deanna.
Yes, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate the opportunity to invite Chandra to come on and for her to share how this has impacted her life and all the great work that she's doing for others.
Thank you. So I'm so thrilled to be here. And if anybody wants to take a deeper dive on the emotional effects of how HPV-related cancers, cervical cancer in particular, affect people, You know, there's an amazing film, Someone You Love, the HPV Epidemic, and that can really help on the call to see the value of what they're potentially preventing with the vaccination effort. And
thanks
actually,
so much,
Indiana
Sandra.
University School of Medicine offers 1.5 CMEs for viewing that. All the women that are in that film are actually friends of mine.
Thanks so much. All right, I'm going to turn it over to Elisa or Dr. Cosgrove. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, Dr. Kepke. We appreciate your contribution this morning. The next thing that we're going to talk about is some success stories. And as I was collecting data from the various practices over this last month, I heard many of you share some aha moments that you and your practices have had. So we are going to be hearing from the Bozeman Clinic this morning and share your successes and insights this month.
Gladly. So we're up here in Bozeman. We have a team of four doctors that are involved in this project, been meeting a couple times a month with a group that includes our clinic manager, an RN, one of our nurses has joined our group, and an RN care coordinator, as well as a receptionist, and then a patient care tech. That's our core group that meets to discuss our successes and our challenges. We are in the process of locating a HPV cancer survivor advocate. One has been identified, but there's some challenges with confidentiality that I understand. So we're still working on that. And we certainly appreciate Chandra's story this morning. Drives home a powerful message. So that we have some data from before we started and after, and our initial changes. And I may have shared a little bit of this last time, but we shared the cancer survivor videos with our entire staff. So not only the providers and the nurses who are directly involved with patient care, but the entire staff, including the front staff, so that the messages are consistent. The nurses every morning would start to start their day. Well, every day they have a huddle, and initially, we had them start to review the schedules of each provider and identify those patients who are eligible for the vaccine, where they stand, if they've started, or if they've started. We have posted visual reminders to scan their schedule every day, and it's also now being brought up in the morning huddle as a reminder to scan the schedules and identify those patients, and then now start notifying the providers that we have this many patients who are eligible and what their status is. Previously, we had only a couple of the nurses who were bringing up the vaccine if they were eligible, and then a lot of the nurses were leaving that up to the provider. We initially kept that the same because we didn't want to make too many changes, but in our subsequent meeting, we've amended that. So they began to document in the chart if they were starting to talk about it and offer the vaccine. And again, then had the providers notified that they had somebody on their schedule. So our data prior to doing that, we had 17 eligible, 41% were offered and 24% given. And after we made our initial changes, we had 30 eligible in about the same time frame. 73% offered, 43% given. After that, we met again and made a few more changes. We tried to drive home the point of reviewing the schedule and notifying the provider of who was on the schedule by having that brought up in the morning meeting, the huddle, every day. We shared the CDC information on talking tips for parents with our entire staff. We laminate a sheet of that, the CDC talking tips, and put them in all the exam rooms. And then we had the nurses would not only start to notify the providers, but they would, at the end of the day, start keeping a tally of how many of those that were eligible received the vaccine. And then every day in the huddle the following morning, that's reported out, as well as some visual graphs that are posted out in front of the nursing station to keep track of our progress. Those have been our main interventions. Some of the challenges that we have come upon is, I think a big one is that in Montana, the recommendations to get your pertussis booster are going into seventh grade. So we have years now of patients being told, well, the next time we have routine vaccines is going into the seventh grade. And so when they're now coming back to clinic, even if they're 11 and 12, or sometimes even 13, if they're not headed into seventh grade, the parents are surprised by the message because they were told they didn't need any more vaccines till seventh grade. And so they often will put it off because they hadn't notified their child. That's one of the things we're running into. So we're trying to reprogram all of the provider scripting so that down the road, we will not run into that same issue. But obviously that scripting has been going on for so long, ever since their kindergarten vaccines, that's going to take some time to work its way through. Dr. Henyon is here. Anything else that I...
No, you did a fabulous job.
So thank you for listening. Any questions? I hear our morning huddle going on right now, and I'm sure they're going to address it. I think when we first met in the beginning of January and made some of these changes, old habits are hard to break. And so even though the goal had been to notify the providers of those that are on our schedule, when we met back in February, the beginning of this month, that had been, we noted that was still being done fairly inconsistently. So the morning huddle was our way to try to address that deficiency.
So Chandra Hall is asking, how are you defining missed opportunities?
So we are charting or keeping track of those eligible, which are the 11 and 12 year olds who come in for any visit, as long as they're not acutely ill. If they have some infectious thing going on, we have not been including those as eligible. So the missed opportunities are those that are eligible but do not receive the vaccine. And we are doing our best to document why. And again, some of that is because the kids weren't prepared and the mom wasn't prepared because of our previous scripting. And as everybody on the phone conference knows, there are a whole host of reasons, but with our CDC talking points, our hope is we can, you know, start to address those concerns.
And Dr. Tucker has asked, how has it helped your practice as a whole to have the entire team on board?
Well, I think the consistency of message is going to be the key. We're still working towards that goal to have the messaging start at the very front. If we can identify those patients ahead of time and let the front staff know so that they can put moms on notices, and dads too, I'm sorry if I'm leaving the dads out, on notice when they walk in that, oh, today's the day where your son or daughter is due for vaccinations. But I think it's going to be helpful, not only the consistency of message, but so that the nurses are bringing it up as well. And so by the time the provider walks in the door, it's not a new conversation that we're having, but we can drive home the importance. And I think the videos that we shared and more advocate work, Dr. Henyon notified me that documentary is coming to town soon that was brought up by Chandra, that then our staff is, I guess, more vested and has more reason to advocate for it.
Great, thank you. One thing that I wanted to share from a little excerpt that I got from Deanna Kepka's group in one of the conference calls recently, she mentioned a practice here in Salt Lake City that started giving the message starting at age 9. So as patients came in, they were hearing the message consistently for the 2 years leading up to age 11, that at age 11, that the HPV vaccination would be sandwiched with the other two that you just mentioned. And I just wanted to share that because I think it has some relevancy so that parents and children aren't caught off guard and then potentially don't want to do it because they're not emotionally ready to have a shot that day. I'm going to turn the time over to Dr. Cosgrove for just a moment, and then we will wrap up our call.
Good morning, everyone. This is Bill Cosgrove. Thank you for sharing excellent work. I just want to bring you up to date with some of the overall data. Everybody put in some data for January, sort of baseline data. We had 411 patients tracked, and 209 of them had received a vaccine. So even as our baseline data, we're hitting 50%, which is better than the baseline data for any of our states. So we're already doing good. And it's clear from Dr. Hodgson's remarks that we've got real good plans to do even better. I want to kind of reflect some of the things that Dr. Hodgson said that I think are excellent ideas to share across all of our teams. One is just sort of taking it seriously and having the general meetings. Lives get busy. It's easy to put those off. But if you just plan them, make a promise that you're going to have the meeting, you're going to have the meeting. The second thing is that I think is key is just sharing it across the whole team. If the receptionist isn't on board, the receptionist can easily kind of divert and lessen your efforts. So having everybody on the whole team clearly is important. I think it's an excellent idea to have the nurse start the conversation. We as doctors are a reactive lot. We sort of sit in our office. We don't go out and look for a sprained ankle to fix today. We just wait and see if one shows up and then we help the patient. And so mostly we are attuned by our practice style and our history is to wait and solve a problem as it shows up. That means we sometimes don't think of a problem in advance. We sometimes don't think of preventing a problem. And so having someone else start the conversation. What I do in my own office is that every morning, the nurse prints the immunization forecast sheet, which is essentially our state immunization database. We print it for every child we're going to see, sick or well, so that I have that right in front of me. So I don't have to think about it. It's just there on the top of the chart in my face. So all I have to do is react to it. And it just makes it easier for me because then I don't have to think about starting that chain of conversation. Someone else has started it. As far as the idea that Dr. Hodgson brought up about warning the child in advance, that's where your receptionist, the person who makes the schedule, when they call for the appointment, that's a great person to say, and your child is due for some shots. So the parent is warned ahead of time not to make a promise that you won't want her to keep. And then clearly, all of quality improvement is about Dr. Hodgson's comment about old habits are hard to break. What we're trying to do is shake the dust off of our old habits, see what we like, see what we don't like, discard the parts that are not working for us, and kind of rebuild new habits. And as I mentioned in my own office, I look at the vaccine records for every child, even all of the sick children, because that's sort of a better way to just catch everybody. We have done a great job. We've off to a good start. We've got the baseline data. Now, this month, tweak your systems, kind of make some changes, kind of track your progress, chart it if you can. At the end of the month, enter your data, and it really looks like things are progressing with every office. Got a whole team of folks ready for you if you have concerns, if you hit some stumbling blocks, if you need a new idea, we've got your back. And then one last comment, the film Someone You Love is excellent. It's heartrending. It really focuses our emotions. You know, to act in any kind of concerted way, you need heart and mind. And you can't get to this just with cognitive thought. You sort of have to have it, have to feel why it's important. And really appreciate Shonda's courage to share with us the torment she went through. And then I want to remind you with one more thing. One out of five of our women, one of our five of our female patients, one out of five of our family members are going to experience at least an abnormal pap smear that puts them into that maelstrom of fear and agony until their doctor finally gives them an okay. So realize we're talking about a lot of people, and this vaccine will save an awful lot of people from a lot of fear and agony.
So one last note, the sign-in is on the utahaap.org website under Resources HPV Project. And if you would take a moment to sign in so that I make sure that you are getting credit for this month's call, I'd appreciate it. You can also email me if that's better. And then just one last note that we will be having our next call on Tuesday, March 7th at 7:30 a.m. And I will send out a reminder. Please contact me if you need anything or need the resources that were mentioned to help you further any of your good work. We want to thank you for joining us and have a great week and month.